Hello, the program is Conversation. I'm Jim Tudor. Our guest this month, as was the case last month, is Greg Rhodes, Cincinnati Reds historian, formerly director of the Reds Hall of Fame. And we touched upon this briefly last time, Greg, but we didn't say much about it. You have a book that just came out, Baseball Revolutionaries.
I do, and thank you for having me back on to talk a little more baseball. And
well, I couldn't get it all done the last time. You're a veritable encyclopedia.
Enjoyed the conversation last time. Looking forward to it again. Yes, a new book called Baseball Revolutionaries. It's all about the revolutionary Cincinnati Red Stockings of 1869 and 70, and how they really transformed the game by becoming the first all-professional club. And they had such great success that they were hard to ignore. The clubs didn't play all that many games back in 1869. The Red Stockings played 57 games, but they won them all. And when you win every game, even if it's only 57, people pay attention. And the fact that they had organized themselves as a professional club, put everybody under salary, guaranteed contracts, that really caught everybody's attention and just changed the way the game was organized.
Well, now with a 162-game schedule, people are not happy that the Reds are only winning 57
yeah,
games.
You win 57 games today, that doesn't get you very far.
No, it doesn't. A lot of changes in baseball in 150 years. Which ones are you most impressed with?
Well, I guess it kind of depends on how far back you want to go. Let me give you one change that really made such a huge difference, and it's amazing that it wasn't part of the game right from the beginning. That was the fact that players originally, they didn't wear gloves, if you can imagine. I mean, they're playing with a hard ball.
I cannot imagine.
And they are playing barehanded.
Wow.
And in 1869 and 70, when the Red Stockings were becoming famous and changing the game, they played barehanded. I mean, my gosh, that slap of that ball into your hand, wow. And it wasn't that it was against the rules. They just hadn't thought of it yet.
Right.
And so, in fact, there was really very little equipment at that point. Even the catcher didn't even have a mask and didn't have shin guards or anything like that.
But the ball wasn't as lively then.
The ball was not as lively, but it was still a hard ball.
Still a hard ball, yeah.
And when it came off the bat, if it was well hit or if there was a very hard throw from one player to another, you still got smacked pretty good. And then finally, in the 1870s, 1880s, the gloves became more popular, and over the years have changed enormously. I mean, if people remember back in the 50s or 60s, gloves were tended to be much smaller. I mean, they've gotten much bigger over time, especially for outfielders and first
base.
Not
to mention the other safety equipment that players wear.
The helmets, the batting helmets. Originally, there were no batting helmets.
Right.
There was one fatality in baseball, in Major League Baseball, when a player was hit in the head.
Cleveland Indian, wasn't it?
Yeah, 1920.
Yeah.
And he died a couple of...
Thinking Speaker was his name.
Chapman.
Chapman, okay.
And the pitcher's name was Carl Mays, and he threw underhanded, and he was known for throwing inside. I shouldn't say underhand, he threw sidearm, like a really low submarine kind of pitch. And hard for batters to see, and right. He struck this. I mean, there has never been any suggestion he did it on purpose. It was an accident. But baseball did, they changed a few things then. They made it so that you could use a new ball more often. Oftentimes, they just kept using the same ball throughout the whole game, and by the late innings, it would become quite muddy and dirty and dark, and it was just harder for the hitters to see.
That's how that got. And I often wondered why they use so many.
Yeah, well, now it's crazy. I mean, now they use a ball every time the ball hits the ground. They put a new ball in play.
Yeah,
they'll go through 8 or 9 dozen balls in a game.
Wow!
And of course, back, you know, foul balls now are souvenirs. They didn't used to be. The fans would throw them back in play. But now, of course, that's a
Mets. They
still
do that at Wrigley, don't they?
Yeah, after a visiting home run, right. They don't like that, so they throw it back on the field. But back in the old days, you'd throw it back on the field so it could continue to be used in the game. And, you know, the equipment, the bats have gotten much lighter. It used to be that the players thought that the bats, the heavier the bat, the more, you know, the harder they could hit the ball. Well, it turned out it's just the opposite. Huh. The lighter bat allowed you to swing faster, and it was the speed of the swing, not the weight of the bat, that really made a huge difference in how far you could hit a ball. Another big change over the years, Jim, and was that back in the early days of baseball, when they built baseball parks, they did not build the fences at home run distances. The fences basically just went around the perimeter of the property. And if it happened to be 450 feet to center field, well, that's where they put the fence. Or if it happened to be 280 feet down the left field line, that's where they put the fence. So the idea of home run distances, with the fences all carefully laid out, that didn't come about until much, much later. In fact, I think that when the Milwaukee Braves moved to, when the Boston Braves moved to Milwaukee in the 1950s and they built County Stadium, that was one of the very, very first ballparks that was built with the home run, with the fences as home run, reasonable home run targets. You know, Crosley Field in Cincinnati, when it was built in 1912, it was 420 feet to center field. It was over 400 feet to right field. It was over, it was 370 feet down the left field line.
Plus those terraces out
plus
there.
It had the terrace out in left field. Yeah. And the ball was a little deader back then. I mean, it took 10 years for somebody to hit the ball over the fence for a home run at the old Crosley Field. Eventually, they moved home plate out twice, some 40 feet, and that brought the distances more in line with home run targets. But
hold on a second. If we're going to send this in for a possible award, I don't want to get...
The home run, the fences are now, you know, all designed for the home run and the home run hitters. And I mean, some would even say, given the strength of the players now, and this, and the especially when they use a little livelier ball from season to season, you might argue that the fences are way too short now.
Now you're getting into controversial territory about that live ball and whether or not it is more or less lively. And since we're talking history, we won't go into that too much today. But we are talking with Greg Rhodes, co-author of Baseball Revolutionaries.
Right.
How the 1869 Cincinnati Red Stockings rocked the country and made baseball famous.
Yep.
But Mr. Rhodes did not write it alone. He wrote it with two other people, John Arardi and Greg Gages.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, John is a long time.
Been in here before.
Yeah, you've had him in here before. I'd written some books with John previous to this one. He was a long time sports writer with the Cincinnati Enquirer. He was twice the Ohio Sports Writer of the Year. Quite a career. And then John's gone on to do some other baseball books on his own. He has quite a wide range of interests, and I've always really enjoyed working with him. And then Greg Gages, my other co-author on this book, Greg's been a contributor to baseball research magazines and blogs and so forth over the years, and helped me with a couple of the books that I did many years ago. And so we invited him to become a part of the team. And he contributed significantly to this Baseball Revolutionaries book.
Terrific. I know a little bit about John Arardi and his work. We talked about his trip to Cuba and researching Tony Perez.
Yes, and that resulted in his Tony Perez book, which is still out, still in the bookstores, and is a great read. It's very entertaining. I mean, any of these guys that come out of Cuba, I mean, now you talk about changes in baseball. Perhaps one of the most significant was in 1947 when Jackie Robinson integrated baseball, broke the color barrier. And Latin players, you'd had some Latin players prior to that, but they tended to be very light-skinned. And in fact, they were justified because they had they were of European descent. Is the way that the teams would sort of explain it, because if they were of darker complexion or of African roots, they were not going to be able to play. So the Reds had Latin players prior to Tony Perez and prior to the team, the Latin players that come along in the 50s and 60s, but not very many. But with Robinson breaking the color barrier, that really opened the floodgates. And now minority players make up almost a third of the rosters in baseball. And of course, most of those are Hispanics from the Caribbean, from Mexico, lot of Asian players, African-American players. It's a very diverse game.
Well, I'm 70 years old, and I got to thinking,
and I'm 72. So
I got to thinking last night of just the changes in my lifetime. The addition of the designated hitter, intentional walks. They don't throw four balls anymore.
Right.
That's right. More games per season. An addition of the playoffs between the pennant, the end of the pennant race, and the AL and the NL championships.
Yeah, the season it now goes much, much longer than it used to. It used to start
I think it's
mid-April, and it would be over. The World Series would be the first week in October. And now games are starting in the last week in March, and the baseball season, again, it ends. The regular season will end at the end of September, but then the playoffs take almost a whole month to do. And it is. It's taxing on fans, I think, especially if your team's not involved in the playoffs. It gets a little hard to follow all of that for a month of playoffs.
And the fickle audience, it's just baseball doesn't have the audience it once had, does it?
Well, yes and no. There's been a little bit of fall off in ballpark attendance over the last decade. But there has not been a corresponding drop in TV and radio. For the most part, people still follow their teams, but instead of going to the ballpark, they watch more games on television and they listen to more games on radio. And that's been particularly true in Cincinnati. We've seen attendance fall off in the last decade.
But that was one of the controversies when TV started broadcasting baseball.
Well, you and I both can remember that controversy was red hot back in the 50s and 60s. There was a lot of feeling you don't want to give the product away, and you want people to get to the ballpark. And if they could watch it at home, they'd stay home. And to some extent, that happens. But the TV deals now are so lucrative that teams make money off of TV. Even if the people don't come to the ballpark, their TV contracts are very, very, very worthwhile. But, you know, radio, that predates us, of course, but radio was a big change.
Thank you.
That came along in the 20s, and there was a lot of controversy about radio. Too many games were on radio. That was going to cut into attendance. And then TV comes along a few years later, and it's one of the same issues.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that issue largely has been resolved now because of the fact that the TV contracts, the radio, the broadcast contracts are very lucrative for the clubs, and they don't mind having their games on TV because they still do well financially.
And now MLB has a website.
Yes. Oh, my gosh, the MLB website and the way you can follow the game on your phone has really has changed the way that I'm a fan. I tend to rely on my phone a lot for it. And with the Major League Baseball app, you can – now you have to pay a certain amount. I can't remember what it is. It's not real high for the season. It's somewhere like $20 to $30. But you can listen to every game, every Reds game on radio on your phone. And not only that, but you can listen to every game on
that app.
Well,
it's the same with my satellite radio.
Yeah.
I subscribe to XM 6 months out of the year just so I can hear any baseball game I want to.
Yeah, which is just absolutely amazing. I mean, if you up it pops on your app, oh, so-and-so's throwing a no-hitter in a game and between Boston and Miami or something, or Tampa, you can quickly flip over and listen to the rest of the game, that no-hitter. So there's just been so many changes. And, you know, the stats have gotten more complicated. It used to be, my gosh, it used to be batting average and home runs and RBIs or wins or strikeouts for pitchers, and now there's a dozen stats.
The one I hear a lot now is OPS. What the heck
is OPS? Well, it's an interesting...
It's a combination of two stats.
It is. Batting average, you know, is just a record of how many hits you get per at bat for over as in relationship to your total at bats.
Right.
But if you get a walk and get on first base, well, it's not quite as good as a hit, but it's still very valuable to have a player on base, and so on base percentage counts walks as well as hits.
Right.
So that's useful. Then the other thing is slugging percentage. You know, a guy who hits 300 but only hits singles is not as valuable as a guy who hits 300 and hits a lot of doubles and home runs. And so slugging percentage adds that factor in. And then if you combine slugging percentage with on base percentage, that's where the OPS comes for on base plus slugging, OPS, you get a number that is a good number for showing the overall value a player has.
Greg, I think I need a mathematician in here to help me.
It is. It's you know, batting average still has its virtues.
Yeah, they talk about, what is the term now that they use to describe baseball and the all the general managers are looking at
analytics.
Analytics, and, yeah.
Oh, the sabermetrics revolution.
Oh my goodness!
Yes, and it has really changed the way ball players are evaluated, the way they're scouted, the way trades are made. It's become a very, very critical part of how the decision making goes on, and partly too in how a game is managed. You see the shift a lot more now than you used to.
Yeah.
My gosh, you know, when that happened, I mean, the shift is not new. Ted Williams saw the shift a lot when he played.
Right.
Bertie Tebbets, who managed the Reds in the 1950s, used to use a shift when Stan Musial would come up. He would take one of his infielders, because Musial was a very powerful left-handed hitter, mm-hmm. and so he would take his third baseman or shortstop and put him in the outfield and give four outfielders. Trying to cut off the gaps.
I don't remember that.
And, well, he didn't do it often, but he did do it occasionally. And in fact, it was such a novel thing that it always drew a lot of attention. And well, in one game, Tebbets made the shift. He took his infielder, put him in the outfield. He had four outfielders, and mm-hmm. one of the umpires looked up and saw the four outfielders and called timeout. He thought the Reds had too many players on the field. Well, they didn't, but that's just how novel it was. Now, today, that shift is, well, I mean, it's very commonplace. You see it happen many times a game.
Another example of the Reds leading the way.
Yeah, that's right. Another first for the Reds.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, over the years, I mean, the night game, there's another change. I mean, baseball was a day game up until 1935, at least in the major leagues.
Right.
The minor leagues had night ball before that. One of the fascinating things to me was reading about that very first night game in Cincinnati mm-hmm. in 1935. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the players said, well, it wasn't that new to us. We'd played night ball before. And I'm thinking, how the heck did that happen? Well, the minor leagues, starting in the late 20s and early 30s, began to experiment with night baseball. So a lot of the players had come up through the minors had played night ball. So when they saw it in Cincinnati, it wasn't all that unusual to them. It was to the fans, though, and to the major league audience, because they'd never seen baseball at night. And it just was a miracle to see those bright lights out
And they
there.
Got the president to turn on the lights.
Yes, they did. Franklin D. Roosevelt.
All the way in Washington, D.C. It's a long cord there.
He tapped on a telegraph key, and the telegraph sent a signal to Crosley Field, and that was the signal to turn the lights on. So, yeah, it was a very big deal.
Oh, you took away the mystery for me. I imagine the president just flipping a little
switch. It wasn't quite that easy.
Do you have a favorite moment in Reds history?
Well, I think the most dramatic moment the most exciting game I ever saw was all the way back in 1972. Now, not that far back for you and me, but for a lot of your listeners, perhaps.
Right.
1972, the Reds were, that was the start of the Big Red Machine era. The Reds had been in the World Series in 70. They were favored to win it all again in 72. And they get into the playoffs and they're playing the Pirates. And that was back when you had to win a five-game series to get to the World Series between right. the two division leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And the Pirates had won the Eastern Division, the Reds had won the Western Division. And now they're playing off, the Pirates went ahead, and the Reds came back. It was now tied 2-2, and the final game was going to be played in Cincinnati. And I was teaching school in Louisville, Kentucky. And I used a sick day. I got to admit this. I used a sick day.
And Who can blame you?
In fact, the day before, when they announced there was going to be when the Reds tied it up, now there's going to be a fifth game.
Yeah.
I went into my principal and I said, I'm going to take the day off tomorrow because of this. He was a big sports fan. I knew he'd sort of understand. I'm going to call in sick tomorrow. He said, that's fine. He said, I'll tell you what. He said, when you get up there, see if you can get me two extra tickets. I'll come up too. So he took off about midday and came up. But yes, you could. And that was the amazing thing, was the final game of the playoffs, but there were still outfield seats available. And that was the famous game that the Reds went into the ninth inning down 3-2. And Johnny Bench hit the home run, dramatic home run to tie the game. And then moments later, after a rally, George Foster scored on a wild pitch to win the game for the Reds and to put them in the World Series. That was the most exciting inning of baseball in my experience. What about you, Jim? How would you answer that?
Well, you kind of put me on the spot.
I am.
I happened to be there. It's a long, involved story. I sort of happened to be there when Pete Rose got his record-breaking hit. My bus was late. My landlord gave me and a friend a ride to the stadium, and we were just coming in through the walkways when Pete hit his record-breaking hit. I remember standing there because we weren't at our seats yet, and just feeling the power of the crowd, the emotion of the crowd, and thinking, my God, I'm glad this is a friendly crowd.
That was September. It was an amazing moment. 1985.
Yeah.
Fall of 1985. And, that was a thrill for... of course, that was one of those things that was interesting. Everybody kind of knew it was going to happen.
Yeah.
It was just a question of when. And so people had bought tickets. Those games were almost all sellouts. Pete had tied the record up in Chicago, and then they came back to Cincinnati and played San Diego. And I think the first game Pete played, he did not get a hit.
Right.
And I think he set out the second game, and then the third game he started again and he got a hit early on. But people had come night after night waiting for that hit to come. So you came on the right night.
I got lucky.
Yeah. September 11, 1985.
And I think I bought the tickets at the last minute, too.
You might have. It was not quite a sellout. The first game, I know, was a sellout. The second game might have been a sellout. The third game, the one he got to hit, there were, I think, about 45,000 there. So you had about another 5,000 seats. I mean, we forget about how big Riverfront Stadium was. A sellout crowd there was 50,000.
Yeah.
I mean, a sellout crowd at Great American Ballpark now is about 40,000.
42, 43.
Yeah. Yeah. And at Crosley, sellout crowd was 28-30. Of course, on opening day, if you remember, they'd always oversell the ballpark and they'd have the fans sit out in the outfield on the terrace.
Right.
It kind of provided a natural amphitheater. They'd put wooden seats out there and string up a rope, and any fly ball that landed in those seats was a ground rule double. And in 1954, I think it was the Reds and the Cubs. Hit 13 of those ground rule doubles in one game.
Wow.
And Jim Greengrass, who was an outfielder, played for the Reds in the 50s for a few years.
Appropriate name for an outfielder.
It is, isn't it? Great great baseball name, Greengrass. He had four doubles on opening day. and that tied a major league record. And they were all into those seats. And after the game was over, his general manager, Gabe Paul, was coming through the clubhouse and congratulating the team on their victory. And Jimmy Greengrass, 4 doubles in 1 game. How you feeling? And the young rookie looked up at his general manager and said, "Ready to negotiate."
Greg
now,
Rhodes.
That's a good line, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Greg Rhodes, Cincinnati Reds historian, formerly director of the Reds Hall of Fame. And here promoting his book, Baseball Revolutionaries, all about the 1869 Cincinnati Red Stockings and their undefeated season. And baseball has gone through a lot of changes since then. I don't know how you remember all this stuff, Greg.
Well, you know, I've been studying this stuff now for a long time, and I'm blessed with a reasonably good memory, so I can... You know, you kind of pull these things out.
I listen to the sports talk show hosts, and I listen to you today. You don't have a computer in front of you. You're not looking at notes. You're just off the top of your head. It amazes me.
Off the top of my head, and hopefully most of it was true.
Greg, thank you very much for appearing.
Well, Jim, thank you. Thank you.
A second time. And
I really enjoyed it. It's a great tribute. I know you're doing these shows as a tribute to your late friend, Paul, and yes. I'm happy to have been a part of it.
Okay, I think they want you for pictures out in the lobby. So thank you again, Greg.
Thank you, Jim.